A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about the pro-Israel lobby, beyond the conspiracy theories. Not the cartoon version where a shadowy cabal pulls every lever of American foreign policy, but the actual organizations that openly advocate for the U. What do they do day to day? How do they operate? And how do they try to present a balanced view of the Middle East to policymakers? There's a lot to unpack here because it's simultaneously one of the most discussed and least understood influence networks in Washington.
The timing is right for this. We're heading into the 2026 midterms. Israel policy is more contested inside both parties than it's been in decades, and you've got organizations spending serious money and serious time trying to shape how candidates talk about this stuff. The thing that most coverage gets wrong is treating it as a monolith. It's not. You've got groups that barely agree with each other on what pro-Israel even means.
The conspiracy version collapses all of it into one thing, the lobby, singular, with a capital L, and that's exactly where the anti-Semitic tropes sneak in. The reality is messier and frankly more interesting. You've got AIPAC and J Street actively working against each other in primaries. You've got an evangelical group that's bigger than all the Jewish organizations combined. None of this fits the cartoon.
The existence of nuanced U policy is itself the strongest rebuttal to the conspiracy theory. If this lobby actually controlled everything, the Biden administration wouldn't have held up that shipment of 2,000-pound bombs to Israel back in 2025 over concerns about Rafah. That actually happened. The lobby pushed back hard, and the administration did it anyway. That's not what total control looks like.
The real story is more like a loose network of organizations, PACs, and advocacy groups that operate in plain sight, filed with the FEC, publicly listed, holding conferences you can buy a ticket to. They're not hiding. The question is what they actually do with all that visibility and all that money.
Let's start with the one everyone's heard of, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's the 800-pound gorilla. Their annual budget exceeds $100 million, they've got more than 100,000 members, and their entire model is built on bipartisan congressional lobbying. They're not a PAC directly, they have an affiliated PAC, the AIPAC-PAC, which spent $16.5 million in the 2024 election cycle. That's according to Open Secrets.
$16.5 million. For context, that's real money, but it's not otherworldly money. The National Association of Realtors spent more than that in some cycles, but AIPAC's influence isn't primarily the checks, it's the relationships and the information pipeline.
And this is where the mechanics get interesting. AIPAC's signature move is the fly-in. Their 2025 policy conference drew 18,000 attendees who then conducted 4,000 meetings with congressional offices in a single day. 18,000 people descending on Capitol Hill, prepped with talking points, meeting with their representatives and senators or their staff. That's not a bribe, that's constituent mobilization at industrial scale.
The prep work is substantial. Before those meetings, AIPAC has already briefed the attendees on the specific bills, the amendments, the committee markups coming down the pipeline. They know what's in the defense authorization bill that affects Israel. They know which subcommittee is holding a hearing on aid. They're walking into those offices more informed than most voters who show up to town halls.
The day-to-day of someone working at AIPAC is built around this rhythm. Picture a legislative associate, entry to mid-level, probably in their late 20s. They start the morning reviewing the congressional record for any Israel-related amendments that got introduced overnight. There's always something. A senator from one party wants to condition aid. A House member from the other party wants to increase Iron Dome funding. The associate drafts talking points for the House Foreign Affairs Committee markup happening that afternoon.
Iron Dome funding is a perennial one. It's been one of the least controversial Israel-related appropriations for years, precisely because it's framed as defensive. Rockets get shot at civilians, Iron Dome shoots them down. Nobody can object to that without looking like they're okay with rockets hitting apartment buildings. That framing didn't happen by accident.
That's the information provision function. The AIPAC associates midday might involve meeting with a senator's foreign policy aide to discuss the 2026 defense authorization bill. They're not asking for a vote at that meeting. They're providing a one-pager on why a particular Iron Dome funding provision matters, how much it costs relative to the overall bill, and what the security implications are of cutting it. The aide is juggling 50 issues. The lobbyist's job is to make Israel easy to understand and hard to ignore.
Then the afternoon is coordination, coalition building with other groups, the Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations, for instance. If there's a UN Security Council resolution coming up that multiple groups oppose, AIPAC helps draft a joint letter, get signatories, deliver it to the State Department and the UN Ambassador's Office. By evening, the associate might be at a fundraiser for a pro-Israel House candidate, not writing a check themselves, but helping connect donors to the campaign.
This is where AIPAC's model has shifted in ways that even people who follow this closely sometimes miss. Historically, AIPAC was scrupulously bipartisan. They'd endorse incumbents from both parties. They'd avoid primary challenges, and their whole pitch was, we're friends to anyone who supports the U. In 2022, AIPACAC endorsed 109 Republicans who objected to the 2020 election results. That was a break.
That's a big break. You go from, we don't care about your other politics, we just care about Israel, to, we're endorsing election objectors. And suddenly, a lot of Democrats start wondering if AIPAC is just a Republican operation with a bipartisan sticker on it.
That perception has real consequences for their influence. If half of Congress starts seeing you as a partisan actor, your ability to build broad coalitions erodes. It also feeds the conspiracy narrative. AIPAC controls both parties is a lot less convincing when Democrats are openly criticizing AIPAC and AIPAC is backing primary challenges against them.
Which brings us to J Street. If AIPAC is the 800-pound gorilla, J Street is the organization that looked at that gorilla and said, we think there's a different way to be pro-Israel.
Founded in 2008, self-described as pro-Israel, pro-peace. Their annual budget is around $15 million, a fraction of AIPAC's, but they've carved out a distinct lane. Their whole premise is that you can be pro-Israel and also advocate forcefully for a two-state solution, oppose settlement expansion, and support conditioning aid in certain circumstances. For a long time, that position was considered almost beyond the pale in mainstream pro-Israel circles.
Now it's not. That's one of the most significant shifts in American Jewish politics in the last two decades. J Street normalized the idea that you could criticize Israeli government policy and still be part of the pro-Israel tent.
They've been willing to put money behind that. In 2024, J Street endorsed Representative Andy Kim in the New Jersey Democratic primary. That was a direct challenge to a more AIPAC-aligned candidate. J Street's affiliated PAC spent to help him win. And he did. That's the counter lobby at work.
You've got two organizations that both call themselves pro-Israel. Both lobby Congress. Both run PACs. And they're actively trying to defeat each other's preferred candidates. If the lobby were a monolith, this would be a very strange way to run a conspiracy.
Then there's Christians United for Israel, QFI. This is the largest pro-Israel organization in the United States by membership, claiming more than 10 million members. It was founded by Pastor John Hagee in 2006. Their motivation is evangelical Christian theology, not Jewish communal interests. They see support for Israel as a biblical imperative. Their day-to-day looks different from AIPAC's. Less lobbying markup language, more grassroots mobilization through churches.
10 million members. For comparison, the entire American Jewish population is somewhere around 7.5 million. CUFI is larger than the demographic it's ostensibly advocating for. That alone should complicate anyone's mental picture of what the pro-Israel lobby looks like.
CUFI's influence operates on a different axis. They're not primarily about briefing senators on aid provisions. They're about activating a massive evangelical base that votes in Republican primaries. Their Night to Honor Israel events draw thousands of people in cities across the country. Their pastors preach about Israel from the pulpit. That's influence that doesn't show up in FEC filings.
Then there's Stand With Us, an educational nonprofit focused on campus and media advocacy. They're the ones training college students to counter BDS resolutions, providing speakers for Hillel events, producing social media content that frames the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for a younger audience. Different tool set, same general direction.
They're also the group most likely to be in the trenches when a student government is debating a divestment resolution at 3 a.m. The day-to-day of a Stand With Us campus coordinator is less about Capitol Hill and more about coaching a sophomore through public comment at a university board meeting.
The landscape is AIPAC doing the inside game on the Hill, J Street doing the inside game from the left flank, QFI mobilizing evangelicals by the millions, Stand With Us fighting the campus wars. And that's before you get to the policy shops, like the Israel Policy Forum or the Middle East Institute, which aren't strictly lobbying organizations, but produce research that shapes the conversation.
The Israel Policy Forum is interesting because they inhabit a space that's sometimes called the quiet lobby. They're not running PACs or endorsing candidates. They produce policy papers. Their 2025 report on the cost of annexation modeled the economic and security consequences of Israel formally annexing parts of the West Bank, and the numbers were stark. Billions in lost trade, diplomatic isolation, security coordination with the Palestinian Authority collapsing. They take that paper and brief it to Senate offices, to the State Department, to journalists.
That's influence of a different kind. It's not vote this way or we'll fund your opponent. It's here's what our analysis shows will happen if this policy goes through, and we've done the modeling. In a policy environment where staffers are overwhelmed and expertise is thin, being the person who can walk in with a credible, well-sourced analysis is power.
That's a point worth dwelling on. When people hear lobby, they think campaign contributions. But ask any congressional staffer. The most effective lobbyists are the ones who save them time. If you can hand a foreign policy aide a 2-page memo that accurately summarizes a complex issue with sources they can cite in their own memo to the senator, you've just made their job easier. Do that consistently for 2 years, and they'll pick up the phone when you call.
The currency is reliability. If your analysis is consistently accurate and your framing is consistently useful, you become part of their information diet. That's harder to track than a campaign contribution, but in a lot of ways it matters more.
Let's do the day in the life contrast, because I think it makes this concrete. We walked through an AIPAC Legislative Associates Day, monitoring the congressional record, meeting with staffers, coordinating coalition letters. Now picture a J Street policy director's morning. They're not starting with the congressional record. They're starting with the UN OSHA situation report on humanitarian conditions in Gaza. They're reading B'Tselem's latest findings on settlement expansion. Their midday meeting is preparing testimony for a House hearing on aid conditionality, making the case that EU military aid should come with guardrails.
Their afternoon is different too. They might be meeting with Palestinian American community leaders to align on messaging, not because they agree on everything, but because there's tactical overlap on specific legislation. In the evening, they're hosting a virtual town hall for J Street members on the status of the two-state solution, answering questions about what's actually achievable given the current Israeli government's composition.
The AIPAC person and the J Street person both care about Israel's security. They both want a strong EU, but they have fundamentally different analyses of what threatens that relationship, and they're working toward different policy outcomes. The AIPAC person thinks the main threat is erosion of bipartisan support for unconditional aid. The J Street person thinks the main threat is Israeli policies that make the occupation permanent and erode Israel's democratic character.
They're both lobbying. That's the thing. When people say the pro-Israel lobby, which one do they mean? Because these two organizations are in active conflict with each other.
Which brings us to the current flashpoint, J Street's 2026 primary challenge to Representative Richie Torres in New York. Torres is one of the most outspoken pro-Israel voices in the House, a staunch AIPAC ally, and he opposed a ceasefire resolution that J Street supported. J Street is now putting resources behind a primary challenger. This is a test case for whether the pro-peace lobby can actually unseat an incumbent on this issue.
If they succeed, it rewrites the political calculus for every Democrat who's been assuming that AIPAC support is essential, and J Street's opposition is manageable. If J Street can take out an incumbent, suddenly both lobbies have demonstrated they can hurt you.
Which is exactly how competition in a political ecosystem is supposed to work. It's not a cabal controlling everything. It's rival factions competing for influence, with voters and donors and members of Congress making choices between them.
Let's talk about the Overton window on Israel policy, because this is where the knock-on effect get interesting. For years, the acceptable range of democratic positions on Israel ran from enthusiastic support to support with mild reservations. J Street's entire project has been to expand that window leftward, to make support with conditions a legitimate position within the party.
It's worked. If you look at the 2025 discourse compared to 2015, it's night and day. In 2015, conditioning aid to Israel was a fringe position associated with a handful of progressive backbenchers. In 2025, you had mainstream Democratic senators openly discussing it. The Biden administration's hold on those 2,000-pound bombs was a form of conditionality in practice, even if they didn't use the word.
J Street moved the window. But here's the paradox. AIPAC's response to that shift has been to get more aggressive, more partisan, more willing to back primary challenges from the right, which in turn fuels the narrative that AIPAC is a Republican operation, which makes it harder for AIPAC to influence Democrats, which narrows their influence.
It's a strategic dilemma. Do you stay bipartisan and accept that some Democrats are going to move left on Israel? Or do you go all in on the party that's more reliably aligned with you and risk becoming just another Republican, aligned interest group? AIPAC seems to be choosing door number two, and it's not clear that's a winning long-term strategy.
CUFI is watching all of this from the evangelical side, where the politics are simpler. The Republican base is overwhelmingly pro-Israel. The theology is baked in, and they don't have to worry about a cuffy J Street dynamic because there's no evangelical equivalent of J Street. The evangelical pro-Israel world is much more unified.
Though even there are fissures. Younger evangelicals are less uniformly pro-Israel than their parents. Polling from the last few years shows a generational split. Evangelicals under 40 are more likely to express concern about Palestinian rights, more likely to question unconditional support for Israeli government policy. CUFI's long-term challenge is demographic.
Even the most monolithic-looking piece of this ecosystem has internal tensions. That's the through line here.
Let me pull back and connect this to something concrete. When a member of Congress is trying to figure out their position on, say, a resolution condemning settlement expansion, they're getting input from multiple directions. AIPAC says voting yes will damage the UJ Street, says voting no will damage the prospects for a two-state solution. CUFI's members are calling the office from back home. Stand With Us has a fact sheet on the legal status of settlements under international law. The Israel Policy Forum has a policy brief on the security implications.
The members' staff has to synthesize all of that, plus the State Department's position, plus their own district's demographics, plus whatever the party leadership is signaling. That's not control. That's noise. The lobby's job is to cut through the noise, but the lobby itself is part of the noise.
The balanced view question is interesting here. How does a lobby present a balanced view of the Middle East when its entire reason for existing is to advocate for one side? The honest answer is, some organizations try harder than others.
J Street would say, their whole model is about presenting a balanced view. They bring Palestinian voices to their conferences. They cite Palestinian human rights data. They argue that acknowledging Palestinian suffering is essential to being pro-Israel because the alternative is a forever war that destroys Israel's democracy.
AIPAC would say they present a balanced view by accurately representing the security threats Israel faces. Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the strategic value of the U. Their framing is, we're not hiding Palestinian perspectives. We're contextualizing them within a security framework where Israel's right to defend itself is paramount.
QFI's framing is theological, not geopolitical. They're not trying to present a balanced view in the same sense. Their mission is to mobilize Christian support for Israel as a biblical mandate. They're upfront about that. The balance, such as it is, comes from the fact that they're one voice among many in the broader ecosystem.
The Israel Policy Forum probably comes closest to the balanced view ideal. Their reports explicitly model the costs of occupation. They engage with Palestinian perspectives. They argue that Israeli security and Palestinian statehood are not in tension, but interdependent. But they're a policy shop, not a mass membership lobby. Their influence is among elites, not voters.
That distinction matters. AIPAC and CUFI move votes. J Street is trying to move votes. The Israel Policy Forum moves expert consensus. These are different kinds of power.
Let's talk about what a typical workday actually looks like at one of these organizations, because I think it demystifies the whole thing. We sketch the AIPAC Legislative Associate and the J Street Policy Director. But let me give you a more granular version.
Go for it.
6:30 a.m., the AIPAC Regional Director for the Midwest is at O'Hare, flying to D.C. for a fly-in. She's reviewing the briefing book on the flight, 20 pages on the latest Iran sanctions legislation, the Iron Dome funding line in the defense bill, and a proposed House resolution condemning the ICC. She lands at Reagan National at 9, takes the metro to Capitol Hill, and meets her first group of constituents, a dentist from Skokie, a rabbi from Cleveland, 3 college students from Indiana. She preps them in a conference room at the Capitol Visitor Center. When you meet with the senator's aide, lead with the personal. You're a constituent, you're a voter, Israel matters to you. Then hit the ask, support the Iran sanctions bill. Here's the bill number. Here's the one-sentence case. Don't get into an argument about settlements. Stay on message.
The dentist from Skokie is the whole ballgame. That's the grassroots mobilization piece. The regional director isn't the lobbyist. She's the force multiplier who turns 100 dentists and rabbis and college students into 100 mini-lobbyists for a day.
The meeting lasts 15 minutes. The Senate aide is polite but noncommittal. They usually are. The regional director follows up with an email, the one-pager on Iran sanctions, a thank you for the meeting, an offer to be a resource on Middle East issues going forward. That's the relationship building. Then she does it 4 more times that day with 4 different offices.
The J Street equivalent? Same airport, same metro, but the briefing book looks different. The J Street regional director is prepping our constituents to talk about settlement expansion and the humanitarian situation in Gaza. The ask is different. Maybe it's support the Levin Amendment on aid oversight, or sign this letter urging the administration to oppose annexation. Same mechanics, different policy.
Both of them are doing this openly, with name tags and publicly available schedules and FEC filings. There's nothing secret about it. You can go to the AIPAC website right now and see when their next policy conference is. You can register. You can attend. The secret lobby framing collapses on contact with the reality that these are some of the most transparent organizations in American politics.
The secrecy is in the eye of the beholder, and usually the beholder is looking for a conspiracy. When your meetings are on the congressional record and your PAC spending is on open secrets, you're not exactly operating from a hollowed-out volcano.
Let's get to the actionable part. If someone's listening and they want to understand this landscape without falling into either the conspiracy trap or the nothing-to-see-here trap, what do they actually do?
First, follow the organization's own materials. AIPAC publishes policy briefs. J Street publishes endorsements and position papers. QFI sends newsletters. Stand With Us has social media channels. You don't need a middleman to tell you what they believe. They'll tell you themselves, in their own words, on their own websites.
Second, track the money. OpenSecrets.org has detailed breakdowns of pro-Israel PAC spending by cycle, by candidate, by party. You can see exactly who's getting what. That's a lot more useful than vague claims about the lobby buying politicians.
Third, if you really want to understand how this works, attend a local chapter meeting. AIPAC has regional offices. J Street has local chapters. CUFI has events in churches across the country. These are open to the public. You can walk in, sit down, and watch the machinery operate at ground level. It's less glamorous than the conspiracy version, but it's real.
The fourth thing, and this is the one that requires the most intellectual discipline, is to hold 2 ideas in your head at the same time. These organizations are real, they are influential, and they shape policy in ways that matter. And also, they are not all-powerful, they do not agree with each other, and you policy frequently diverges from their preferences. Both things are true.
The bomb shipment hold is the perfect example. AIPAC opposed it forcefully. The administration did it anyway. If the lobby were all-powerful, that couldn't happen. But if the lobby were powerless, the hold wouldn't have generated the backlash it did. The reality is in the middle, which is where reality usually lives.
The backlash to the hold was itself instructive. Members of Congress issued statements. The administration had to defend the decision in detail. That's influence, not control, but influence. The ability to force a conversation, to make a policy choice costly, to ensure that the decision maker has to weigh the political consequences.
Which is what lobbying is. It's not mind control. It's making your issue salient enough that politicians have to factor it into their calculus.
Let's look ahead, because the landscape is shifting. The 2026 midterms are going to test a lot of assumptions. If J Street succeeds in unseating a few AI PAC-backed incumbents, the political cost-benefit analysis changes for every Democrat. If AI PAC's Republican alignment deepens, their bipartisan brand erodes further. And if the Democratic Party continues to fracture on Israel, you might see a split in the pro-Israel lobby itself.
The open question, and I think this is where we should leave it, is whether the bipartisan model survives. For decades, the pro-Israel lobby's core pitch was, this isn't a partisan issue. Both parties support Israel. We're building a broad coalition. That pitch is harder to make in 2026 than it was in 2006. The parties are further apart. The internal debates are louder. The Overton window has shifted left in one party and right in the other.
You could imagine a future where we stop talking about the pro-Israel lobby and start talking about two distinct lobbies. One aligned with the Republican Party and focused on unconditional support for Israeli government policy, including annexation, and one aligned with the Democratic Party and focused on a two-state solution with conditions on aid. The seeds of that split are already visible.
That would be a fundamentally different political landscape. The lobby as a bipartisan coalition is a much more powerful creature than two partisan lobbies fighting each other. If it fractures, the influence fractures with it.
Which would be, in its own way, a vindication of the argument we've been making. The lobby isn't a monolith. It's a coalition under strain, and the strain is showing.
The advice for anyone trying to understand this space is, read the primary sources, track the money, attend a meeting, and resist the urge to collapse a complex ecosystem into a single noun. The reality is more interesting than the cartoon.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, a naturalist in the Outer Hebrides published a paper attributing the vivid purple pigment of a local nudibranch to a diet of heather pollen. The claim stood for over a century before a Glaswegian chemist demonstrated in 1891 that the pigment was actually a waste byproduct of the slug's own metabolism, not its diet at all. The naturalist had simply assumed the color had to come from somewhere he could see.
A vivid purple waste byproduct.
That was almost a metaphor for something. We'll leave it there.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. Go read some FEC filings. They're more interesting than the conspiracy theories.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.